Welcome back once again to Principles of Environmental Toxicology. I'm Greg Muller, the instructor for the course. Today's lecture, Environmental Chemodynamics, is a continuation of the series, short lecture series that we have here in the ETOX course about environmental chemistry. And what we'll try to do today is actually take a lot of what you learned in freshman chemistry and pack it into a dozen or so slides, just so that you're reviewed, well-reviewed in terms of the context of considering how chemicals move in our environment. What happens? What's the energy dynamics, the bookkeeping, so to speak, of chemicals in the environment? Tell you a short story here. This past week, my wife and I celebrated our 20th wedding anniversary. And a good husband that I am, hopefully, sent her some roses. And she was remarking to me how wonderful the smell was, and nodding in agreement as a dutiful husband, thinking in the back of my mind from my PCHEM training, this is thermodynamics at work. This is, in fact, fugacity, the fleeing tendency of those aromatic molecules from the rose through the air and into my olfactory senses. In a certain sense, what we're going to try to do today is perhaps not as romantic as perhaps roses, but it is a way to understand why things happen in the environment. Why, for example, when we have a point source release of an environmental chemical, a contaminant of concern, why, in fact, there may be receptors downwind, downstream, across the pond that, in fact, are at risk. The risk has to do with thermodynamics and also the kinetics of the chemicals involved in this particular release. Our learning objectives here today, what we're going to try to have you do is list the thermodynamic functions that are used to describe the various energy states of molecules in an environmental system. We talked about the importance of energy and energy drivers last time when we looked at abiotic mechanism. What we're going to do this time is take a look at energy states of molecules and the reactions that those molecules can undergo in terms of our construct called thermodynamics, where we have attempted to understand the nature around us. We'll try to do this by understanding the relationship of something called Gibbs free energy. You should recall this from freshman chemistry, the big G, the delta G, the free energy, and its related term, chemical potential, and how these terms actually help us understand the transfer or this various transformation of chemicals within an environmental system. I'd like to have you develop a basic understanding of a term called fugacity and its role in environmental transformations. Just like my roses, fugacity is the fleeing tendency. What makes those aromatic molecules that are held tightly in that rose actually hit my nose? It has to transport from the rose across the bridge of air and into my nose. We'll try to have you as well define activity and its relationship to concentration. All semester we've talked about risks and dose and concentration terminology. What we're going to do is at least find out or review the concept of activity. The fact that we have to have at least a little bit of understanding that what we're dealing with in this complex natural world around us is in fact a non-ideal situation. So from an ideality point of view, concentration terminology, milligrams per kilogram, is a good way to think about things, but in the non-ideal world, the actual complexity of this real world around us, we have to at least be able to consider that there are relationships in terms of concentration that are not exact, and this is where activity helps us at least understand that. We'll try to also have you understand the concept of energy bookkeeping. If you recall again from freshman chemistry, you had to look at a series of chemical reactions. Sometimes those were electrochemical reactions, if I go back to the Nernst equation, to decide that if you put a series of chemicals together, whether the reaction was going to be spontaneous or not. or whether you had to put energy into that chemical reaction to make it work to the other side. You had to heat it up, for example, or in the cases of photochemical reactions, one of the chemicals had to absorb a photon to have sufficient energy to allow for the reaction. It's an endothermic reaction. It requires energy input. We'll talk about this and its relationship to Gibbs free energy, and also we'll introduce again for you or review the terms enthalpy or heat energy and entropy, the confusion, so to speak, of a molecular state in phase transformation or chemical reaction. Once again, we'll also have you try to develop a basic understanding of what you learned in freshman chemistry about chemical kinetics, and especially first order and pseudo first order chemical kinetics. First order, pseudo first order, are the most important representations of how fast things happen in environmental chemistry. Obviously, you'll have to have a respect for the fact that there is other potential kinetics out there, complex multi-stage reactivity, but in terms of understanding environmental chemistry, at least at this level, if you have a solid understanding of first-order chemical kinetics, you have mastered most of the domain of chemical kinetics associated with the environment. There are other aspects to this. If you review your freshman chemistry, remember integrated rate expressions, half-lives, and temperature dependence through the Arrhenius equation. We'll again throw that at you just as again to tweak your memories so that you're aware of this as we discuss environmental chemistry. We're also going to then switch over into environmental modeling. Thermodynamics is a model of the natural world around us. It's a way we try to understand how and why things happen. We told you that this lecture was about the whys of environmental chemistry, why things happen. Here, in terms of modeling, we're going to let you at least take a peek inside how people that manage environmental toxicology and environmental chemistry try to reduce the complexity of a natural system through modeling. We introduced the initial concepts of modeling in our risk assessment lectures, the idea being, again, that we take this incredibly complex risk basis and try to reduce it down to the fundamental variables that are most important, that are best descriptive of this complex system around us. We have the same sort of mentality in terms of reducing down the complexity of nature when we talk about environmental chemistry. We'll try to do that through increasing your understanding of the partitioning of chemicals and how partition coefficients are used in describing environmental systems. We've already tried to introduce that in our fundamental toxicology discussions when we talked about lipophilicity and octanol water partition coefficients. The octanol water partition coefficient is a very simple exercise where we have a test tube that's full half of octanol, which is a very lipid-like alcohol substance, and water. And so this oil, octanol, floats on water. And in fact, by putting a chemical in there, we can see the chemical partition between the two phases. And that tells us a little bit about how it might behave in a complex natural system. These, again, are approaches to modeling these complex chemicals in a complex environment. We'll try to have you understand some of the basic approaches to modeling, chemodynamics, and the various limitations and various usefulness of all of these models in terms of, again, trying to not only understand, but more importantly, to predict certain outcomes. And those predictions are important in terms of setting up a basis for risk assessment. Well, environmental chemodynamics may or may not be a term that you're familiar with. It's a little bit of a synthetic term that talks about chemical reactivity in this context in the environment. It actually pulls together the concepts of thermodynamics and kinetics into one word. And so this kind of just lets us know that we're kind of dealing with these model systems. We're trying to understand nature. These processes are very important in being able to describe the fate and transport of environmental chemicals. Again, the idea that we want to understand not only nature around us, but the impacts of natural activities and human activities in terms of preventing or limiting or mitigating contamination and therefore toxicology. You got to recall one of the underpinnings of this lecture and the whole aspects of thermodynamics is that energy balance will drive the system. Whether or not a chemical reaction is endothermic or exothermic will tell us a lot about whether or not certain chemistry will happen. We'll try to actually illustrate that with some chemistry or chemical reactivity in our natural world that is very allowable, but in fact kinetically slow. Phase transfer and chemical reaction dynamics help in terms of the transfer of chemicals from one phase to another. Think about it next time you use cologne or perfume or deodorant, you have a solid or liquid solution that has a fragrance in it. You apply that and within seconds or minutes later, you smell the desirable odors, the various chemical combinations that the fragrance chemists have put into the solid or liquid state and allowed for a phase transfer, a very pleasant phase transfer if you look at the alternative in terms of standard body odor or sweaty underarms. When we talk about environmental chemodynamics, we are very interested in interfacial and intercompartment transport. We've talked about how we like to take nature and in terms of a modeling approach, divide it up into little boxes. When you think about how we could do that, think about, for instance, dividing two boxes in a contaminated water system, a lake that has an undesirable volatile chemical in it. One of the boxes will be the water itself. The other box will be the air over that water. What's the interfacial intercompartment transport, and what are the drivers in terms of the release of these volatile molecules? We hope to describe those here today. Now, thermodynamics is the study of systems at equilibrium. And although physicists and physical chemists do a pretty good job of coming up with systems to equations and models to describe non-equilibrium thermodynamics, primarily, especially at the level of thermodynamics that you've had in your preparation for this course, we can consider thermodynamics to be equilibrium situations. These are reversible processes. Equilibrium implies that what can go in one direction can go in the opposite direction as well. So for example, when we have a solid phase contaminant in a aqueous environment, there will be an equilibrium concentration that will be established over time. This equilibrium concentration will be driven by primary thermodynamics. We use thermodynamics to describe the energy status of the molecules in an environmental system. Again, we're talking environmental chemistry here, not just lab bench chemistry. There are various thermodynamic functions. Again, these are constructs, way we have tried to describe this natural world around us over the past 100, 200 years. We've tried to identify why things happen. And so in a certain sense, physical chemists and physicists have come up with a set of mathematical representations of why things happen. We'll review here today chemical potential. You'll use the term mu to identify chemical potential. Fugacity, which is a new term for you, or the fleeing potential, why we smell the pleasant smell in roses. Activity coefficient, most of you should recall this from freshman chemistry. Gibbs free energy, the big G. And then its related terms, the heat energy or enthalpy of a chemical reaction, and the entropy S of a chemical reaction. Now, we have a relationship in terms of describing molecules and their internal energy. It's called chemical potential. All molecules have these internal energies, their vibration, rotation, translation. They have external energies as well. When I used to teach freshman chemistry, again, I used to have the students stand up and rotate and vibrate their arms back and forth as a demonstration of these complex energy levels that are associated with molecular states. Now, those energies that those molecules have are environmentally related. When I talk in this context, it's the local intimate environment of the molecule. And that environment has to do with its temperature, ambient pressure, and the chemical composition, what your neighbors look like and act like in terms of an environmental chemical system. Now, the energy content of a chemical is a population concept, okay? So it's the collection of molecules, but we talk about chemicals in terms of changing from an independent chemical point of view. The population of a chemical and all the other substances present is another way of talking about the total free energy of the system. We can relate free energy to chemical potential. Now think of this, you know, in terms of a model. If I were to take a molecule and add it to a collection of molecules, you will add a change. You will change the total free energy of the system. It's a fairly complex process. It's population based, but it's the incremental energy as these additional molecules that are added to the total free energy of the system. This is one of the fundamental descriptors of thermodynamics. For the next few slides, I'll put a little bit of differential equations at you. These are very, very basic. To translate these for those of you that haven't had enough differential equations in your mathematical background, all we're talking with these D's here, the deltas, delta G, and this is an energy term in kilojoules, changing for each mole of a particular molecule that's being added, defined at some temperature, pressure, and a number of molecules. And we're just defining that the change in free energy for the change in population of these molecules is defined as a chemical potential term. This chemical potential is an energy term per mole of molecules, okay, in the system. And so that's just a way to do this. Essentially, we're collecting this in this integrated expression here, that the free energy, again, defined at a particular pressure, temperature, and a collection of the molecular environment that this molecule is added to, is in fact a sum of the chemical potential. It's a population concept of all of the molecules in the system. You won't be using chemical potential to do much, but it's nice to understand it as, again, one of the fundamental underpinnings of chemical thermodynamics. Well, as it turns out, we have no idea of how to assess the individual chemical potentials of chemicals added to a system. So what we do is we infer reference or standard states. So we define these standard states, and then what we can do is look at the change that happens when we add this. So we can always talk about the change in terms of thermodynamics, but we can't determine absolute energy levels. So what happens in terms of coming about with these reference states is that we have to understand that there will be a spontaneous transfer of chemical and thermal energy until equilibrium is reached. So we have an energized system. It's like a roller coaster at the top of the hill. It's going to go downhill until it reaches the bottom of that plateau. If it has sufficient energy, it actually continue perhaps up the next hill. The chemical potential can be used to quantify the tendency of this compound to actually go through some sort of transformation or transfer to another system. These absolute values, as I said, cannot be calculated, but we can define the chemical potentials from changes in a reference state that can be defined. A reference state, for example, one might be an infinite dilution pure liquid state, and we define these typically with standard chemical conditions like pressure and temperature. You'll hear, you recall from freshman chemistry, STP, standard temperature and pressure definitions. Temperature of 298 degrees Kelvin, for example, is the standard temperature, and one atmosphere for pressure. And that will yield a standard chemical potential, always signified with a zero. And so we can determine or define this standard chemical potential in a reference state, and that will be a point of comparison for the starting and final states of a molecular change. And so we can use this as a basis to calculate whether or not something is going to be spontaneous or a chemical reaction that will be non-spontaneous and therefore require energy inputs. Another term that is very useful in environmental chemistry is the concept of fugacity. Fugacity is a little bit easier to understand if you just think of it as the fleeing tendency, the migration, the energy released to equilibrium that allows for chemicals. If you put a drop of food coloring in a glass of water, at the moment that very concentrated solution of food coloring hits the water, you'll see a very dark, bright spot if it's a red color at the top of the glass. Over the next few seconds and definitely over the next few minutes, you'll see that red color develop throughout that entire glass. What has happened? There's a certain amount of energy that has been released from a concentrated state to a dilute state, so there's a fleeing tendency there. We typically will talk about fugacity when we're talking about release of volatile substrates. We can define certain terms in the fugacity F equation, where we have a fugacity coefficient and a mole fraction. What's the concentration differential? If you're sitting in or you have a system that is somewhat saturated in a chemical, you're not going to see a fleeing because, in fact, you have an equilibrium balance in that solution. We can define P sub I as the partial pressure of gas I, and remember partial pressure from your freshman chemistry. But you have a relationship here that the fugacity is equal to this coefficient times its mole fraction times its partial pressure. This fugacity coefficient is approximately equal to 1, and so fugacity is about equal to partial pressure. So if you recall, again, from freshman chemistry discussions, what partial pressure is, the mole fraction of gas in a collection of gases, then fugacity is directly proportional, is related to that partial pressure. Now, it turns out that liquids and solids also have vapor pressures, and they can also have a fleeing tendency, a fugacity, and we can actually work out the thermodynamics of the fleeing tendency of both liquids and solids. We can do this by having a reference state partial pressure, P sub I, 0. And then defining the terms, this gamma sub I, which is the activity coefficient. Activity coefficients, again, recalling freshman chemistry, account for non-ideal behavior. And so we can come up with fugacity being equal to this activity coefficient times the partial pressure of the vapor state of that liquid. And the same thing for a pure solid, the activity coefficient of that pure solid. And that's proportional to the reference state of the partial pressure of that solid. This allows us to develop a fugacity term where we have the activity coefficient, again defined by that partial pressure, which we saw before as being the mole fraction times the partial pressure of that pure liquid or pure solid. And this again has the ability, since the activity coefficient is close to 1, sometimes we can have a direct relationship between fugacity of various liquids and solids. This is again just helpful for us understanding why things happen in an environmental chemistry context. Activity is a way to describe how a compound in a given state is compared to a reference state. We like to think of activity as an apparent concentration. It's thinking of activity as concentration is justified in most cases, although you have to recall that you are dealing with a non-ideal world, and therefore absolute or apparent concentrations are going to be different. In terms of activity, what we'll have is an activity coefficient, which again helps describe this non-ideal activity, this non-ideal concentration, and that's going to be multiplied by the mole fraction of the substance in an analysis to give us the activity. Note that we can also define activity in terms of the relationship between the fugacity of a compound and its fugacity in a reference state. So it allows us, again, to relate fugacity or the concentration, the fleeing tendency to these non-ideal concentrations. The other terms in thermodynamics, again, to review this energy bookkeeping that we'd like to at least have a basic understanding of in terms of respect for why things happen in the environment, is enthalpy, which is designated by H, and entropy, which is designated by S. Both of these terms, these energy terms, contribute to this activity coefficient, since they help to describe the non-ideal molecule-to-molecule interactions within a system. Now, to define enthalpy, it's the heat energy, as I've said, it's the sum of the inter and intramolecular forces of a molecule, whereas energy, which is the freedom or chaos term of molecular interactions, is the contribution to free energy of a molecule by randomness of configuration, orientation, and translation. And again, this goes back to all of our chemical thermodynamics that we learned in freshman chemistry. What this does for us, it helps us establish a system of energy bookkeeping. And again, this is a way to kind of understand what will happen out in the environment subsequent to, for example, a contamination incident. There can be a way to look at molecular changes in the environment, various phase changes such as volatilization and chemical reaction. They require an energy change because, in a certain sense, think about it, volatilization, a phase change, a chemical reaction is a change of molecules, a change of state of molecules, a change of molecular conformation, molecular shape size. All of that will happen with chemical reactivity. And so to bookkeep all of this, we'll take this basic equation of free energy is equal to the heat enthalpy H minus the temperature times the S, the entropy, equaling, again, the chemical potential of the system. So thus, we can calculate the molar free energy changes, or delta G, of an environmental process. So if we have a way to define the state changes before and after, we can look at the delta G, which is the change of these processes. And we can then use the delta G, if you recall, to predict spontaneity. Predicting spontaneity is extraordinarily useful because it tells us not how fast things will happen, but in fact if things will happen spontaneously. We can also use these delta G terms to estimate equilibrium concentrations. And again, you can recall from freshman chemistry, when you did electrochemistry, you could use the Nernst equation and its derivations from delta G to define if an electrochemical reaction involving exchange of electrons was going to be spontaneous. Was it a spontaneous battery type energy producing reaction, or was it the reaction that you had to hook an external energy source up, the external battery, to drive the chemical reaction? Now, let's shift over, now that we've managed to take an entire, perhaps, 3 or 4 week tutorial in chemical thermodynamics and reduce it down to a half dozen slides. Let's do about the same thing with chemical kinetics. Again, just to review what you need to be very aware of when you're talking about environmental chemistry in the context of environmental toxicology. Chemical kinetics is very simply the study of systems whose chemical composition or energy is changing with time. And so this is a time-based phenomenon. Now, unlike thermodynamics, where we can calculate and model the system, chemical kinetics is actually an experimental discipline where we actually have to go to the lab and study chemical reactivity and actually determine how fast things happen from a laboratory study. Now, thermodynamics is very good at telling us whether things will or can happen. Just because they can happen does not necessarily they will happen in the time frame that is realistic for us. You'll perhaps have heard the term geological time. There are, in fact, many environmental processes that happen in the environment, but they happen in geological time. In other words, the kinetics is so slow, it in fact takes thousands or perhaps even millions of years for a chemical reaction to really take place to any sort of observable degree. An example of that will be the reaction of atmospheric oxygen and nitrogen with seawater. As it turns out, this particular chemical reaction of water plus nitrogen, atmospheric nitrogen, and atmospheric oxygen actually has a product of nitric acid. And in seawater, at the concentrations of oxygen and nitrogen that we currently have in the atmosphere, it would make the seas extremely acidic, about 0.1 molar nitric acid. The question is, in fact, if this delta G here is a minus 355 kilojoules per mole, this in fact is a spontaneous chemical reaction when we take a look at it from a thermodynamics point of view. Okay, so this reaction is happening out there. The question that the students have to ask themselves is, why don't we have oceans that are highly acidic solutions of 0.1 molar nitric acid? Well, as it turns out, this particular reaction, although chemically spontaneous, is a very, very slow reaction. So when we actually measure this, it's extraordinarily slow. It's geological time. There's other sorts of competing reactions, carbonate reactions and whatnot, that happen significantly faster. And so the pH of our oceans is highly buffered. And in fact, we don't see this, although it's spontaneous, it is not of an environmental chemical concern. Now, one of the things we like to do in environmental chemistry is take a look at reaction pathway, because mechanism can help determine chemical kinetics. We introduced this a little bit when we talked about abiotic environmental chemistry, when we looked at organic chemicals, and we looked at, for example, SN1 and SN2 reactions. There were various, you'll saw in the designation of the formulas, RLS, or rate limiting steps. That essentially are the slowest step in a fairly complex reactive pathway. We have the ability to be able to study chemical reactions and get a sense of the mechanism. And when I say a sense, we can never fully determine exactly what is happening because of the complexities of observing things on an atomic or molecular basis. However, via spectroscopic studies, via various sorts of physical chemical analysis processes, we can come up with very good descriptions of reaction pathways. The mechanism of a reaction includes all of these individual steps along the pathway from reactants to products. And so when you look at those SN1, SN2 substitution reactions, you saw that there were various steps in terms of molecular associations of reactants yielding the final production of products. The rate of reaction, how fast a reaction happens, may be limited by any one of those steps. And again, you saw those rate-limiting steps in those nucleophilic reactions that happen in the environment. The molecular properties of the reactants and the products do allow for a calculation of equilibrium constants for a reaction, but they do not allow us to calculate rate constants. And so we can get some thermodynamics. We can understand the delta G, the Gibbs free energy changes associated with a chemical reaction, and therefore predict its spontaneity. but we cannot predict how fast things are going to happen, and so chemical kinetics is a laboratory exercise. Now, in chemical kinetics, we are concerned about the rate of reaction. This is what tells us how fast things we will go. This rate of reaction is a function of several variables, typically the chemical composition, what our concentration is, the temperature. There's the old saying in chemical kinetics that increase by 10 degrees in a chemical reaction is about a doubling of reaction rate. Things happen when they have a higher level of ambient heat energy. It's also a function of the pressure and the volume of the reaction. If we take a look at kind of a standard representation of a chemical reaction, and we have number of moles of A and B reacting to form products P and Q, P moles of product P, Q moles of product Q. We can define a rate as in terms of moles per liter second as a disappearance. And so this is the change in the concentration. That's what these D's mean, again, recalling, over a change in time. So the disappearance is a negative term here of reactant A, and this is divided by a coefficient of 1 over the number of moles in that reaction. That rate will also be defined as the disappearance of, can also be defined as disappearance of reactant B. Or alternatively, we can take a look at observing the appearance of the product P or the observance of product Q out here. And again, all of these are equal to either the disappearance or the appearance of any of the individual constituents in this reactive pathway as being an indicator of the rate of reaction. When we have this rate equation here, in this particular case, the disappearance of a reactant, we can actually integrate that to get an integrated rate expression. But for this particular representation, many of you that are in chemical engineering type fields may have heard of Fenton's reaction. This is an oxidative pathway that's used to oxidize organic chemicals in environmental contamination situations, spills, groundwater, soil. This is an interesting reaction because with ferrous iron in an acidic environment, if you add hydrogen peroxide, H2O2, you actually oxidize the iron to ferric iron to produce water, but the pathway here actually produces radicals, and primarily hydroxyl radicals, very potent oxidizers. And so it's important to understand Fenton's reaction kinetics in terms of its potential application to remediation or contamination control. We would represent the rate of reaction as equal to the disappearance of the reactant peroxide over time, or alternatively, the disappearance of ferrous iron over time. Okay, and here in this, you see that we have a 1 over 2 multiplicand here because we have a 2 moles in terms of the stoichiometry of this particular chemical equation. Now, we can look at and examine the concentration of dependence. If we have high concentrations of reactants, this can drive a chemical reaction faster. So if we have this rate equation, this integrated rate equation, that the rate is equal to some sort of rate constant here, small k, multiplied by the concentration raised to the exponent of the number of moles of that particular material, we can use that to examine the concentration dependence of a rate equation. One of the examples of doing this is actually an air pollution chemical reaction. When we drove our cars today, our internal combustion engines produced nitric oxide, NO. Nitric oxide is an air pollution component because what happens when it is released from our exhaust pipe, it goes on to react with atmospheric oxygen. It can also react in the internal combustion engine as well. It produces nitrogen dioxide, NO2. NO2 has kind of got a caustic smell and flavor. If you've ever driven in urban areas with air pollution problems and seen a brown or an orange haze over the top of this urban area, what you're observing is NO2. We can take a look at the concentration dependence of this NO2 reaction. If we have a rate dNO2 over dt, one half of that, it can be represented as this rate constant times the concentration of the reactants, NO raised to the power of 2 times the other reactant, O2, this concentration. And this is enables us to identify or to put into play the concentration dependence of a chemical reaction. We can use these rate expressions, we can integrate these and come up with some information in terms of modeling or predicting the outcome, especially when we can identify the order of the reaction. Many chemical reactions that we're concerned about in environmental chemistry follow first order or pseudo first order chemical kinetics. Recalling again from your freshman chemistry orientation in this, that pseudo first order just means that if we have two chemicals that are reacting, one of them is in large excess concentration compared to the other, and so we can reduce down the integrated rate expression to essentially eliminate the one that's a minor constituent in terms of overall concentration. In terms of an integrated rate equation, here's our rate, our disappearance of a reactant A over time. We get a rate constant that is dependent, that is a multiplicand of that concentration. We can integrate this expression. Upon integration, in fact, in a first order reaction such as this, we get a natural log of the concentration at any point in time divided by the concentration at zero time is equal to a minus times the rate constant times time. What we do, again, in freshman chemistry is we plot the logarithm of A versus time, and that will be a nice straight line with a slope of K. That K is the rate constant. And this is how, if you recall, we deduced rate constants for these first-order chemical reactions. The same sort of thing in a pseudo-first-order, but here, because B is much, much more concentrated than A, the change of concentration, the rate dependence will actually be limited by the rate of, by the concentration of the B component in this chemical reaction. We also recall from our chemistry introduction that there, and also from some of the discussions here in Principles of Environmental Toxicology, that we can use various kinetic descriptions to compare rates of reaction of different chemicals. One of these is looking at the half-life or the T1/2 of a chemical reaction. It, again, is useful for comparing chemicals and how, for instance, they might react or degrade in the environment. You recall when we talked about the SN1-SN2 nucleophilic substitution reactions, we can compare their lifetime, their half-lives in environmental conditions. You saw that some of those were on the order of hours for water hydrolysis, and others were on the order of months or even years. In first order, when we actually just insert, instead of the concentration, but the half concentration of the original concentration into the integrated rate expression, we can then just run this down and get what these half-lives will be. For first order reaction, a T1/2 is going to work out to 0.693 over K. Hopefully that is familiar to you. You should have all memorized that in freshman chemistry. You thought you'd never use it again, but in fact, we use it all the time in environmental chemistry. In pseudo first order, T one half is equal to log of 2 over the rate constant times concentration of V. And then for second order, we have another one, rate equation, half-life equation that was very useful to determining second order rate expressions and visiting half-lives of those kind of reactions. You recall also that we can determine, at least empirically, the temperature dependence of reaction rates. This is useful. The environment is changing temperature. If you look at how things will happen in the wintertime, engineers always have to do this for constructed treatment systems. We also need to do this to have an identity of what's going to happen and how fast it's going to happen. The differential in temperatures in many parts of the world between the seasons of the year, between summer and winter, can be on the order of 100 degrees Fahrenheit or about 30 degrees centigrade. These temperature oscillations do drive organic chemistry. Things moving slower at lower temperatures in terms of its temperature dependence. But you remember that we can develop this empirical relationship called the Arrhenius equation, that the rate constant is equal to this frequency factor, pre-exponential factor, times the exponent of an energy term, and RT. And we can use graphical interpretations of this called an Arrhenius plot to determine the temperature dependence of these reaction rates. And again, these are useful in environmental chemistry to look at the differences of how things will happen during the normal cycling of temperature during a day or during different seasons. Now recall that we have said that most of the chemical reactivity we deal with in the environment can be first order or pseudo first order, and so that serves us quite well. But often, for example, we have to deal with more complex reactions like heterogeneous reactions where we have surface effects on reactions. We talked about one heterogeneous reaction in Principles of Environmental Toxicology when we discussed the reaction mechanism of the ozone hole. Recall that we had a gas phase chlorine radical that was reacting on the surface of cloud droplets. So we have a liquid surface and a gas phase reactant. This is a heterogeneous reaction. We can also have competitive reactions where we have combinations of various elementary reactions that are used one or more of the same reactants. We can have consecutive reactions where we have sequential processes, and some of these can happen at different rates, and the slowest of these will be the RLS, or rate limiting step, associated with this complex reactive pathway. We're going to switch over here in this environmental chemodynamics lecture to talk about if we, in fact, have these molecular descriptions of processes, whether or not things will happen in thermodynamics and how fast they happen in chemical kinetics. Let's talk about how we would use these to describe environmental systems. One of the ways we try and take these complex environmental systems and reduce them down to where we can actually put them on a piece of paper and actually use the tools of thermodynamics and kinetics in terms of predicting risk is by invoking compartments. And this is where we take the behavior and effects of various environmental pollutants and we start compartmentalizing them in the various major compartments of the ecosphere. Those compartments include the atmosphere, the hydrosphere, the lithosphere, and the biosphere. Okay, you recall that here in Principles of Environmental Toxicology, I have often invoked the fifth compartment of the liposphere because there are many chemicals of concern in environmental chemistry, environmental toxicology, that seem to actually sequester themselves in this fifth compartment of fat, typically in organisms and in environmental chemicals. When we take a look at looking at these four or five major compartments in terms of environmental chemodynamics, we are very interested in looking at the interfaces between those compartments, because quite often it's the interface that is going to actually change or challenge the mobility and perhaps even the risk of that chemical to living organisms. These interfaces are where these two different compartments meet, and they share a common boundary. And so if we were to take this box model, if we were to reduce this down to a workable situation of compartments or boxes, where these two boxes connect, is in fact an environmental interface. These are very important in terms of the dynamics, because quite often we're looking at things like phase changes, changes in terms of released potential for exposure. These are driven by the various physical chemical properties of the chemical itself. This is, in a certain sense, the nature of the beast. Not only the beast as the molecule of concern, but also the chemicals that make up the particular compartment. We're very concerned about the transport properties. For example, if something is in water, perhaps volatilization is a way to decrease the concentration from the local water environment. We talked about heavy metal toxicity and various fungi that can actually bioalkylate heavy metals and make them into volatile substrates, helping to detoxify the local soil environment. So there is an energy input by the organism to detoxify the local environment by doing a phase change with something like a heavy metal, something you wouldn't necessarily consider in terms of the chemical transformation of a mineral heavy metal. When we are talking about environmental chemodynamics, we can reduce down all of these different compartments to the various natural processes that might happen in terms of allowing transformation or transport from one compartment to another. When we're talking about air, we're concerned with diffusion and dispersion. If in fact that rose was just sitting there in a warm room for a while, you might enter the room and find that the smell has diffused throughout the entire room, and perhaps even in the entire household. In terms of the interaction of air and solar energy, we worry or are concerned about photolysis and various potential for oxidation processes, because we have numerous oxidants such as singlet oxygen and hydroxyl radicals from photochemical reactions in the atmosphere. We worry again about heterogeneous reactions on airborne particulates and also on cloud vapor as being some of the compartments and processes in environmental chemodynamics of air. For water, we're concerned with not only the fundamental solution properties and solubility, but also the ability of a chemical to sorb or to adsorb onto a solid substrate, and that can be an organic substrate like a decaying piece of wood, or a mineral substrate like an iron oxide mineral on a rock. We can have diffusion as well in aqueous systems. We can have volatilization. We'll talk about Henry's constant, or the ability for volatile substances to escape aqueous solutions. And as well, we can have biological uptake, because we do in fact have critters of many trophic levels, whether it be single cell organisms or complex life forms that are in aqueous environments. And biological uptake is a potential transformation of chemicals in aqueous systems. Because these are environmental systems, there can be interaction, as we've seen in our photochemistry discussions, photolysis, especially near the surface of aqueous systems. We can have hydrolysis, or the reaction of the water molecule itself, and nucleophilic reactions with various environmental chemicals. We can have oxidation, we can have various metabolisms associated with organisms, and we can have also microbes essentially cleaning up the environment with a biodegradation process, sometimes to the point of complete mineralization, taking complex organic molecules, reducing it to carbon dioxide and water. In soil compartments, we are also concerned with the interaction primarily of soil and water in terms of the ability of soil systems to sorb certain types of environmental chemicals. There is a potential for runoff and also volatilization or leaching, leaching sometimes into groundwater stores that are used to service drinking water needs. And there can also be an interaction with plant systems and in the root zone in terms of biological uptake, and also in the soil-dwelling critters such as earthworms. We can have chemical processes such as hydrolysis and oxidation and reduction. There can also be photolysis because soil systems do have the ability to absorb photons. There can also be various metabolic processes, soil microbes and biodegradation happening. And we discussed, for example, petroleum degraders that are used in land farming applications to degrade petroleum hydrocarbon spills and various contaminations associated with diesel and hydraulic fluids and gasoline. With biota, these are a little bit different in terms of compartment and processes, in terms of environmental chemodynamics. Why are biota different? Mostly because they can move around. Think of a duck that is feeding on a contaminated ecosystem, perhaps not particularly highly toxic, but in a certain sense, that duck has the ability to take to the wind and transport those chemicals against an energy gradient because it has the ability to put energy, its own muscle energy, into the transport of those contaminants to another ecosystem. Because of the cycle of life, that duck becomes a part of that new ecosystem when it dies, and there has been this up energy transportation of contamination. In biota, we do have uptake. We have potential for metabolism, the biotransformation that we discussed in our basic toxicology lectures. There's also the potential for elimination of metabolites. With lipid-soluble and with bone-soluble contaminants, we have the potential for sequestration and, again, the potential for transport. When biota decompose, it has the potential to not only have concentrated contaminants, but also to transport those contaminants. And there can also be a biotransformation or biodegradation of some complex molecules into less toxic or more toxic metabolites. So to look at some of these environmental processes and properties, we can look at physical transport in terms of the actions of the environment on chemicals. In terms of physical transport, these can be from mineralogical processes such as wind, air pressure differences due to thermal and physical landmass changes, allowing for the development of winds to be able to transport not only volatile substances but air buoyant particles and dust ups from one place to another. There can be a biological uptake where we have biomass and food chain effects. We can have sorption processes where the organic content of various soils and sediments can have an impact in terms of the sorption capacity of a sediment or a soil on various types of chemicals. These processes can be driven by the adsorption and chemisorption processes. These reversible adsorption processes and the somewhat irreversible chemisorption, where we actually have a chemical reaction of one substance with a solid substrate. Other processes include things like volatilization. These can have an interaction with various physical factors such as turbulence, wind velocity, various evaporation, aeration rates, organic matter. What I'm trying to set you up with, by the way, is a recognition of the complexity of the systems that we are fundamentally going to model. as you take a look at just a simple chemical in a natural environment, all of these have to be determined as being major contributors or minor contributors in the development of a model. We'll have to look at, in a site-specific way, runoff and the precipitation rate, whether or not in certain environments the soil is a highly porous soil and therefore it limits the amount of runoff, or is it a clay pan soil that you have maximum runoff and perhaps shedding of some of the sediment on the surface of the soil. Is there going to be leaching of contaminants, some of these naturally occurring contaminants in terms of weathered mineral surfaces? What's the adsorption coefficient? How might pH changes, things like acid rain, develop enhanced leaching of some of those weathered mineral surfaces? What about fallout and particulate that are taken up at one site and deposited on another because of high winds? If you go to various satellite images, especially of the north coast of Africa in the summertime years, you'll see some of the tremendous sandstorms in the Mediterranean, where hundreds of miles crossing not only national boundaries but also continent boundaries. The winds of northern Africa hoisting a tremendous amount of particulates up into the atmosphere and then depositing that miles and miles away. We also have to be concerned in terms of environmental processes and properties with the potential for chemical reaction all along the way. It is a very reactive environment out there. Some of these are catalyzed reactions. There can be photolysis. Photolysis is going to be a function of the solar irradiance or the photon density that we have at certain frequencies. We talked about reaction quantum yield when we talked about photochemistry. How many photons are available and what is the yield of those photons for fundamental photochemical reactions? We have to be concerned with the transmissivity of water. Are we talking about very clear water that might be received from a fairly high photon flux through a fairly deep surface area, or is this particularly cloudy water where the suspended sediment particles in this chocolate brown water are in fact going to absorb or reflect any sort of light photons that might enter the water? We'll need to be concerned with oxidation. The world as we know it is a reasonably oxidizing environment. We have to be concerned with the concentration of oxidants, the power, the oxidation strength of those oxidants, and what might be the competing or retarding reactions of those reactants, oxidizing reactants. We have to be concerned about hydrolysis. Is this chemical going to react at what pH? Will there be a interaction between sediment or soil pH as well as the aqueous system pH? Will there be an absence of oxidants, an absence of oxygen, and the potential for reduction and perhaps the interaction of ferrous iron concentration as a potential reducing agent associated with natural systems. We'll talk a little bit about the role of iron reducing bacteria here for a moment, that in fact in the subsurface there is a potential, a very strong potential for iron reducing bacteria to use the chemical energy associated with iron substrates in a reduced environment as not only a terminal electron acceptor, but as a major way to oxidize organic contaminants as a food source. There can also be biological processes. Chemicals can be biotransformed. This can be a function of the microorganism population. We can have an overall effect of biodegradation and in some cases biomineralization, again, where we take a complex organic compound and we fully oxidize it to carbon dioxide and to water. Now, what we're going to do here is go through several parameters that are very useful in talking about environmental chemistry and the relationship of chemicals to various types of environmental systems. One of the most important is just the fundamental solubility in water of a particular chemical. This has to do with the abundance of a chemical per unit volume in terms of its definition in an aqueous system. And that is defined, its solubility in water is typically defined at 25 degrees C and 1 atmosphere, so standard temperature and pressure for the definitions that you might find in a textbook or a table. The saturated solution concentration is an equilibrium situation where we have the solid in equilibrium in an aqueous phase. This C sub W is a saturated concentration. This is nice to know because we are not typically going to exceed the solubility in water. This also suggests that there will be some situations, and we'll talk about some of them in later lectures, where, for example, because we have approached this saturation, if we have a significant amount of parent material in the solid or concentrated liquid form, because we have the release to the aqueous system dominated by this fundamental property of solubility, what can happen is this can extend the amount of time that a contaminant can actually bleed off, if you will, its soluble or solubilized from the parent compound into the surrounding water. We found this with, for example, PCBs in water. PCBs are an organic substrate, not particularly soluble, and so in the local environment around a PCB pool, if you will, at the bottom of a lake, there will be a saturation-limited sort of transfer of PCB to that water over time, essentially saying that for a very, very long time there will be a bleeding off or a leaching of that parent compound into the surrounding water. So this is a problem that's going to be with us for a long, long time. We can also take a look at atmospheric water partitioning, and again what we're doing here is we're partitioning between two compartments, in this particular case the gas phase compartment of the atmosphere and the water, the aqueous phase component of water. This is an equilibrium partitioning, typically described for organic compounds, and this again is between the gas phase and aqueous solution. The partitioning coefficient, again just like the octanol water partitioning coefficient that we talked about already, is called Henry's constant. It's either a capital H or a K sub H. You'll see both designations out there. Simply enough, it's just the ratio of the partial pressure of that substance to its concentration of the pure solute in water. There are fugacity implications, and so here's a way by determining the Henry's law constant, and these are typically tabulated for materials in the same way we had you look up the octanol water partition coefficient for a range of chemicals from a database, an online database. The same sort of thing can be looked up for Henry's law partition coefficients for a range of chemicals. Henry's constants do have fugacity implications. If we have high vapor pressure and high fugacity in water, we should actually have appreciable partition from water to air. In other words, if we have this substance with these properties in water, over time that is going to volatilize out in a fairly reasonable time frame. Now, we've introduced partitioning to this course when we talked about the octanol water partitioning coefficient. Typically, these are organic solvent water partitionings. So the one we use mostly is octanol water partition. This KOW down here at the bottom of the slide is the concentration in the octanol phase, the oil slick on top of the test tube, over the water phase. And this helps us define if something is lipophilic or not in terms of environmental systems. These are natural partitioning processes. There can be a way to kind of look at what happens in environmental systems. I've said a few times in here that sometimes fish can be considered like little sticks of butter floating around in aqueous systems. In terms of partition coefficients, they are the organic phase. They are the, in terms of an equilibrium relationship with organic molecules that are in the water. Octanol is in fact a surrogate for looking at this partitioning processes. Various pathways are important in terms of looking at the relationship of organics to organic chemicals to water. This can be a surrogate for various soil or organic carbon processes in many environmental systems. There can be also a solid water partitioning. These are typically called adsorption isotherms. This is a reversible sequestration of a solute on a solid surface. There's several different kinds of adsorption isotherms. They're called isotherms because when they're done in the laboratory, they're done at constant temperature. In a Freundlich isotherm, there is a Freundlich constant that is developed, and this actually just helps us relate the concentration that's on the solid substrate, the solid surface, how it's been adsorbed out of solution from the concentration in water. And you see that there's our linear proportionality here. And there's a constant here that actually is a case-by-case basis in terms of the particular substrate and the particular solid substrate and the particular organic molecule that you're talking about, or inorganic molecule as well. The idea is that we've just got a partitioning coefficient, this K here, our distribution, and the relationship is the concentration on the solid divided by the concentration that remains in the water. So if you were to do this in an experimental basis, what would you do? You'd have a known concentration of a contaminant in water. You would add a solid substrate, mix it around perhaps for 24 hours. That substrate might be, for example, sand. The idea here is to see how much of your contaminant actually sticks to the solid surface, how much remains in solution, and this will help us identify some of the processes or model some of the processes that would happen out in the natural world. We can use this also in various applications, such as the ability of organic matter, and typically this is solid organic matter, not necessarily dissolved, but it can be both ways, but the partitioning of a chemical between the aqueous phase and the organic matter itself. Organic matter is sometimes abbreviated OM. And so we develop this KOM, this organic matter water partition coefficient. We could jump down here to the bottom of the slide, and you can see that this is the same sort of thing. It's the concentration of your contaminant that is on the organic matter versus the concentration that remains in solution. This is especially important when you think about some of the waters you've probably swum in, you know, whether it's a river or a lake or a pond. You will sometimes see floating or suspended organic matter. Sometimes there's algae. Sometimes there's decayed leaves at the bottom of the pond. Sometimes there will be dissolved substances that just give the water a tea color. And what happens is these dissolved and suspended organic molecules have the ability to sequester or partition the organic molecules. As it turns out, some of this organic matter in solution have large globular polymeric chains. These humic fulvic acids are quite often polyanionic. They can actually, because they are organic, organic molecules typically, or sometimes, especially if they can be a little bit on the nonpolar side, if they're larger molecules, they can actually wrap around and form globules, typically with the more polar functional groups on the outside, and sometimes the less polar group on the inside. And in fact, these globules become little microregions, especially in the inside of this globule where it is hydrophobic. An organic molecule that is also somewhat hydrophobic will find a very comfortable environment inside this organic matter. So there, you can have a capture or a solution region on a micro scale for these various neutral or non-polar organic pollutants. And so we can actually demonstrate that certain lipophilic substances such as DDT or PCBs actually will be more associated with the organic matter, the dissolved and suspended organic matter in a water solution than in the just suspended in the water solution itself. This is kind of a basic sort of common sense sort of thing, but you have to kind of respect the complexity of natural waters to understand this well. We can also have a biota water partitioning. This is referred to sometimes as a bioconcentration factor or BCF. It describes the partitioning of chemicals between an aqueous source, typically water source, and biota. Typically what we do is we define a BCF as the concentration that's in an organism and the concentration that's in water. Typically, it's a water concentration, but you can also examine BCF, bioconcentration factors, looking at the concentration of one organism to, for instance, a food substrate organism like zooplankton, and do the bioconcentration of the two trophic levels. Because we find that bioconcentration is often associated with this solvation of lipophilic chemicals in adipose tissues, we can also view this as being somewhat this fat water partitioning that we've talked about many times in here. And we can take a look at this bioconcentration factor in relationship to other empirical relationships, such as the octanol water partitioning coefficient. You would expect in most cases for instance, lipophilic chemical compounds, that a high octanol water partition coefficient would also allow for a high bioconcentration factor, that there would be a magnification of the food chain. The one thing you need to remember about this, because we're dealing with potential equilibration and concentration driven increases up the food chain, if we remove the source of chemical, we quite often witness a depuration, which is where there will be a redistribution or a release, because we don't have the concentration pressure on the organisms anymore. And so the overall concentration, once the source is removed, the concentration that's in the biota will decrease over time. Now, in environmental systems, we sometimes want to be able to use these compartment models to actually develop model systems. There are many people in environmental chemistry, environmental toxicology, that use these processes that we've listed here today in developing very sophisticated models that in many cases are very good at predicting outcome. Remember our discussion about the ozone hole. That was actually based on a prediction of fundamental photochemistry, atmospheric relationships, the development of a heterogeneous mechanism of atmospheric chemistry that actually allowed us to hypothesize and develop a better understanding of the development of a natural phenomenon, this ozone hole, from anthropogenic release of the CFCs. Modeling is an important part of what we do in science in terms of trying to reduce down this complex natural world into something that we can manage and do something about. This helps us with life cycle assessment. It helps us with mitigating contamination in the past, balancing our activities against the environmental quality and public health. Quote from Schwarzenbach in his Environmental Organic Chemistry textbook, "A model is an imitation of reality which stresses those aspects which are assumed to be important and then it omits all properties that are considered to be non-essential. So there's a choice here. We can obviously sit down and review in this lecture all of the potential inputs, all of the different physical processes, chemical processes, kinetic and thermodynamic processes that might be happening in our system. But at some point in time, especially when we have a lack of information, if we have a lack of information, we are going to be doing scientific guessing. The more guessing we do, the less likely our model is going to be accurate. And so we try to focus down these essential inputs to our model and then do the best job at that we can at collecting the data as inputs, or at least to having good assessment of what that data is. Now, in terms of the strengths of a modeling approach, we use mathematical models in all areas of science. It allows us to simplify complex system. It allows us to predict chemical behaviors in environmental systems. We can use it to explain field data and various observations to make sense out of what we observe. We can use it to predict hypotheses. In a certain sense, we've done this with global warming and the change of carbon dioxide levels and how we've modeled what might happen in 50 or 100 years with regards to global warming. We can use this to design experiments to come up with the best situation in terms of the investment of resources in laboratory studies. Models typically can be modified. We can make them less complex or more complex depending upon a case-by-case need. And we can allow for the development of alternative explanations as well for natural phenomena. There are some weaknesses. We can oversimplify a situation. In fact, we might think we have a pretty good model of what's going on, when in fact, in a particular application, it might be too simple to explain a change in a fundamental variable or involved in a new environmental system. Models are never as good as real observations and real data. And the other thing that we face with modeling, and those that are involved in modeling recognize this, is that there is an obsolescence. In a certain sense, approaches to modeling have become obsolete, and new models have developed that better describe what nature is serving us. The computer revolution of the last several decades has made modeling a little bit easier than it was perhaps in the back history of hand calculations. But even still, we can get lost in the complexity. I hope to end today's lecture with at least a one-page demonstration of a modeling exercise that I was involved in. When we take these approaches to modeling these complex environmental systems, at some point in time we have to define what we are modeling and what we are not modeling, and typically the approach is the development of what's referred to as a control volume. What we do is we try to establish system boundaries and then start looking at the relationships of the different boxes, the control volumes that we're dealing with our air. We can get too broad too fast, and our model becomes too generic and doesn't teach us much about anything in terms of our specific application. And so defining boundaries is an important part of model system development. As an example, we'll take a look at what's referred to as a one-box mass balance model. This particular mass balance bottle is perchloroethylene, or PERC. PERC is a dry cleaning solvent that has some use still, even though it's a problematic chemical. It's C2Cl4. This is the electron distribution, the yellows being the chlorines in this particular molecule. The model that we're going to talk about is the air-water exchange in a ponded system. It's fed and drained by a creek. There is some boundary fluxes that we can define. We'll just define the letter G. This isn't the Gibbs free energy. This is just a term here. This is the exchange of this perchloroethylene between the water and the atmosphere. the pond to atmosphere flux, which is the mass movement from the pond to the atmosphere, we can just arbitrarily call the positive direction. We can define the term S as the net removal of the perchloroethylene to the sediment that's in that particular pond. And then within the pond, there might be some microbes that actually find perchloroethylene as a food substrate. And so there might be some biodegradation processes as well that somewhat compete with the volatilization processes. This is a figure to kind of graphically illustrate what we're talking about in this ponded ecosystem. And so we've got, it's a stream-fed pond, so we have a contaminant input. And since it's drained at the other end, we have a contaminant output O here. So input defined as I, output defined as O. Remember that we defined the flux G, the release of volatiles in this direction as positive. This is the perchloroethylene C2Cl4 molecule. There's a certain area of the pond. There is a system boundary. We're going to go ahead and define that as the interface relationship between sediment and the water itself. There will be a mass and volume of that water. And then we've talked about two other dissipation rates of this chemical. And this is a transboundary relationship with the sediment, or S. And then also this biodegradation rate, R, where in fact there's some level of degradation that's happening in this pond from this particular contaminant. So we've defined our system, we've defined our inputs, our outputs, and our fluxes. How do we put that into a mathematical equation? We can look at that as the change in the mass and the control volumes, that's d over time, dt. And that's equal to, very simply, if we set this up as the sum of the inputs plus any sort of internal production. This is a generic equation. There's not going to be an internal production in this particular case because environmental systems don't make perchloroethylene. So we have the inputs plus any sort of potential for internal production. But in terms of this change over time, we're going to have to also look at the sum of the outputs, what's being released through all of the sediment, biodegradation, volatilization, and release out of the stream exit, minus the internal sinks that we find. And so if we take a look at the change in mass of perchloroethylene over time, dmdt, that is equal to, again, the rate, the input rate from the stream that's heading in, minus the output rate in terms of the stream that's draining this particular pond, minus the flux of the perchloroethylene in terms of the volatilization, which you'll have to respect is going to be a function of Henry's law constant, minus the reaction or biodegradation associated with microbial activity in the pond, and minus the sediment adsorption or reaction. And so this gives us a general mathematical relationship, which we then can start looking at solving all of the inputs. And so if we have this dmdt is equal to all of these different rates, I minus O minus G minus R minus S, we can assume that at any point in time that this is a steady state system. Everything is in a steady state, it's not changing. And if dmdt is equal to zero, we can also assume that in this particular case, and we'll have to justify these assumptions, that the sediment degradation rate and the biodegradation rates are much, much smaller rates of change than, for example, the influent, which is coming in from a contaminated area, maybe upstream, and maybe the mass that is draining out of this particular ponded system, out of our control volume, and then also the gas transport, the gas exchange flux at the atmospheric interface with the water. Since we've assumed steady state, dmdt is equal to zero, we can identify all of these, and especially minimizing these two, we can calculate that in fact this G is equal to the input minus the output. And so that makes not physical sense to you. If you take a look at the input and you take a look at what's draining out, that anything that's different, because we've assumed that these other rates are going to be very small, that in fact the difference between that is what's being exchanged at the gas at the atmospheric interface. So we can then subtract the output from the input mass over a time period, and this net loss of PERC will be the loss to the atmosphere by the system. And so this is a one-box model. We've done some simplifying assumptions, and this is what we do in modeling to come up with what we would predict to be the concentrations over time. Now, this is a very simplistic approach. We can go to much more complex approaches. We can do dynamic box models. We can make models as complex as anybody cares to spend in terms of the time and the input data. You talk about very large lakes with different temperatures at different depths and different turnovers of water. All of these inputs can become tremendously complex and good employment security for modelers. We do, in some applications, require dynamic models to describe the effects of various system variables that are changing. So our assumption of steady state, dmdt, the change in the mass over time, is not equal to zero. And so in this particular case, we cannot come up with a steady state assumption, which simplifies our life quite easily, so we actually have to do all of the calculations. We can also have multiple boxes, and not just a one-box model. We can have random factors, random transport. We can have wind events, storms. We can have diurnal variations. We can have photons during the day and no photons in terms of photochemical reactions at night. These dynamic models require a description of various system processes. There, we have to invoke various theories, relationships, and imply and develop data for various dynamic transport and various transformation processes. An example might be, for instance, in that gas flux exchange, that might not be just a simple Henry's term or volatilization coefficient. It might be a function of the area, the surface of the pond, the air-water transfer velocity, the air-water concentration, and Henry's law constant, such that we get a lot more variables introduced into these models just for that one particular term. We might also want to take a look at in situ reaction of the chemical, various hydrolysis, photolysis, redox reactions as a function of pH, temperature, light intensity. We'll need sometimes to take a look at mass transfer of the chemical at the water surface due to various wind velocity events, temperature changes, reaction of the chemical in the sediments, sequestration, sorption, various degradation and bioturbidation, or the turnover from soil or sediment dwelling insects. We'll need to look at biological uptake and transformation via metabolism, various sequestration and elimination processes from all of these different chemicals. So you can see that as we start getting into the modeling field, good modelers need to develop good approaches to coming up with all of these system variables and identifying assumptions where we can make our lives a little bit simpler in terms of coming up with a definitive model that helps us predict reality for the future. Some of the other inputs that might be required, the inlet input of contaminants at various depths. Anybody that has ever gone diving in a freshwater ecosystem knows that the surface water is significantly warmer than the deeper water. There can be thermoclines and changes of concentration dynamics at various levels. There can be outflow of the water body at different surface and subsurface levels. There can be a mixing of surface water with groundwaters and deeper waters. For example, in some environments, a lot of the flow in a ponded ecosystem can be in just a surface flow, and in fact, the very deep subflows can be somewhat static. There can be in situ production of particulates and phytoplanktons and biological processes. There can be various sorption dynamics, not only on in solution, but also in suspended matter. There are many relationships that we can develop in terms of various partitions. They do require an understanding of chemical partitioning, transformation, and transport to describe all of these equilibrium relationships. These relationships, once we've defined them, understood their kinetics, understood their thermodynamics, help us develop models that are robust and very useful and do help us predict. It's always easier and less expensive to do a model than to do an actual system analysis development, trying to identify all the different variables in all of the different potential natural sites that contamination may impact. This final slide, I wanted to give you again a sense of the complexity of modeling. This is output of a selenium sheep model in terms of potential toxicity of selenium impacted grazing areas to sheep survival. This is from a program called VenSim. This is a graduate student. All I wanted to show you here is this is one page of a very highly developed model in terms of looking at all of the potential intakes. Some of these intakes have to do with plant levels of selenium, water levels of selenium, the amount of exposure, microbial processes. The 50 or so arrows you see just on this page have to do with actual mathematical relationships and modeling of variables and certain types of assumptions. We can vary those assumptions in terms of fundamental concentrations with these toggles here, 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 in terms of food uptake and the type of grasses. We know how certain types of plants sequester selenium. We can toggle in certain types of conditions, create a dynamic model. The output is down here. This is the time on this axis. This is the concentration of selenium on this axis, 0 to 2 parts per million. 1 part per million would be considered to be a threshold for toxicity in the ovine species. You can see that as these animals are put on seleniferous pastures, you can see that there's a rapid increase in this model of selenium, a plateauing, especially as it starts, they become acclimated a little bit, but there's still an increase. But you can see that if we do take these animals off this selenium seleniferous pastures at this point in time, there is a decrease in concentration over time. It looks a little bit like an exponential decrease. This is a depuration. That depuration allows us to not only predict what's going to happen with the safe amounts of time that these animals can spend near seleniferous forage, but also how long it will take them to recover from higher levels than required of selenium in their diets. And so this gives you thorough review, hopefully, and introduction to environmental chemodynamics, how we use chemodynamics to understand the natural world around us. Next time, what we'll do is we'll delve a little bit more into the environmental transport phenomena, finish up this segment of the physical processes of toxicology, how toxicants might migrate and be transported throughout the natural world around us. Until that time, we'll see you. Thank you so much.